to Tea, Tonic, and Toxin, a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a cup of tea, a gin and tonic,
but not a toxin,
and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
Hello, everyone. We are double excited about our second episode today, where we will be talking about the mysterious affair at Stiles. And we also have our super amazing special guest, Jill Karstens. I always know the first name.
That's our special guest, who we love very much, it is.
Miss Jill.
I know Jill.
Miss Jill.
Jill Karstens. But before we start asking Jill a million questions, we want to give some time to today's amazing sponsor, Carolyn Daughters. Carolyn runs game-changing corporate brand therapy workshops, teaches online marketing bootcamp courses, and leads day-long persuasive engine writing workshops. Carolyn empowers startups, small businesses, enterprise organizations, and government agencies to win hearts, minds, deals, and dollars. You can learn more at carolyndaughters.com. I feel like I said persuasive engine writing workshops wrong. What does that mean? Persuasive engine writing.
Persuasive writing engine.
It says engine writing.
Does it?
Yes, it does.
That sounds cool.
I didn't get it wrong this time.
Yes, it's meant to be persuasive writing engine. That's so persuasive writing engine.
Ah, folks, that's what it is. We're gonna steal Jill's pen.
Yeah, you just mark that right up there.
Correction.
Yeah, they're this proprietary persuasive writing course that I created, and I teach for government agencies, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Air Force, and large corporations.
Awesome.
Very impressive.
Excellent. I read it and I was like, that's not feeling correct.
I was imagining a persuasive train running down the
right?
track.
Right? I know. Persuasive engine.
See? It's all coming together.
It works.
And if you've listened to our last episode, I'm going out of order. You've already met our amazing guest, Jill. She was a teacher for 30 years, folks. Now she's concentrating on writing. She's a journalist and writer of narrative nonfiction. She's also a painter and an outdoor lover. When she's not podcasting with us, which is like all of the rest of her life.
So the other 99.87% of her life.
She's hanging out with her husband and
her son
in Denver, Colorado. I got it, Carolyn. And Salida. It does look like you wrote Sonic, but it says Sun.
In my defense,
in Denver,
I wrote Jill's bio live while I was reading Jill's bio.
I'm just saying, sometimes when I slow down, we don't have to bring attention to it because no one will notice. And I get to say lots of great things today. We have a listener award to a super special listener. Now, she's already won a listener award, Jennifer Z. You have, but this time she gets to win an even more special award if you've been looking on our Instagram or our Facebook. We've been running a contest. How many entrants did we have to that contest?
I believe we had 217 entrants.
Oh, I thought it was 240-something.
Yeah, I think I made up the number. It is 200-something.
It's 240-something, rather. Yes.
It's 200-something.
Thank you for all those who entered. But Jennifer Z took the prize, which was a free copy of The 39 Steps. So thank you, Jennifer Z from Michigan, for being such an awesome listener, reader, and social media engager.
And she got a book, and guess what I put inside that book?
A sticker. $20.
Jennifer, the $20 is not in the book. The sticker should be in the book.
Awesome. Thank you, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're ever having a contest again, but you could certainly get a sticker. Mm-hmm. How do you get a sticker?
You get a sticker by commenting on our website, which is tetonicandtoxin.com. We have a contact page, and we also have one page for every single book that we do with contact forms on the page. You can also comment on our Facebook and Instagram pages at Tetonic and Toxin.
Yeah. Yeah, or you could like post a picture of yourself reading the book and then tag us and we'll feature you.
We will.
And send you a sticker, probably.
Well, I think the sticker's a given for the... If you're uploading a picture of yourself reading the book, you're probably going to get a sticker.
Yeah, do it! Do it, everybody.
Do it.
Okay, what's our book, Carolyn?
Our book is The Mysterious Affair at Stiles by Agatha Christie. It's our first of three Agatha Christies this year, and it's the very first book in which Hercule Poirot appears. Very exciting.
Yes, and said beautifully.
Agatha Christie's debut novel was published in 1920, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. The story begins when the narrator, Arthur Hastings, returns to England from the Great War due to an injury and is invited by his old friend John Cavendish to visit his home at Stiles Court. Not long after Hastings arrives at the country estate, John's wealthy stepmother, Emily Inglethorpe, is found poisoned in her locked bedroom. Captain Hastings asks an old friend, Hercule Poirot, to investigate. Poirot is a retired detective and a refugee from Belgium who lives nearby. Emily Inglethorpe had been his benefactress, and he takes the case to avenge her death. Suspects are plentiful in this Golden Age detective story. Suspicion falls on everyone in residence, including John Cavendish and his younger brother Lawrence, Emily's hired companion, Emily's young ward, and a famous poison specialist. The greatest suspicion falls on Emily's new husband Alfred, who's 20 years her junior. Then the evidence seems to point to John Cavendish as the killer. The dramatic denouement takes place in the Stiles Court Salon, where Poirot gathers the entire household to reveal the truth. So who killed Emily Inglethorpe and why? Can you spot the red herrings and discover the truth of the killer's identity? Outsold only by the Bible and Shakespeare, Agatha Christie is the best-selling novelist of all time. Hercule Poirot appeared in 33 novels, two plays, and more than 50 short stories published between 1920 and 1975. Today, we're excited to talk about Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. It's our fourth book selection of 2023. You can find all of our 2023 book selections on our website at tetonicandtoxin.com.
Go there. Leave a comment. Win a sticker.
All kinds of good stuff.
Jill, what was most interesting to you about this book? No, I see you have a lot of cool notes there.
That's a a big question. What did I like? What was your question?
It's open ended. I used the word interesting. So you can really answer it however you want.
Definitely the whole false clue piece. Interesting, and as I mentioned before, frustrating, because I wanted to solve it myself and worked hard at that, actually. A lot of my notes had to do with trying to figure it out.
Oh, that's cool. You took notes while you were trying to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, and I marked up the whole book with my, that's notable, and this is, you know, that's what I do.
Feel that.
And we talked about, in the previous episode, about the wanting to connect with characters, although Poirot, and I'm very impressed with Carolyn's French pronunciation, I will say. Did you take French?
I was a school? French minor.
There we go.
There you go, folks.
I was a Russian minor, so things were guttural for me. I don't have that savoir-faire, the French language. Anyway, I don't know if I have a good summary of what I think. However, I did mention that I had never read an Agatha Christie, and I'm pretty hooked. I really enjoyed it.
Good.
But I, knowing what her writing is like from watching some of the movies, I do see this first book showing kind of a template for future books, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of cool and interesting. And I did read up about her a little bit and understood that that first World War had an effect on her knowledge of death
and drugs. And poisons. And yeah. So she worked in a in a dispensary.
I think she did.
Yeah.
That's Which is cool. their word for hospital. Right?
Yeah.
Well, it's the pharmacy of like, part of the hospital, okay. right? Like okay. Cynthia worked in the dispensary mm-hmm. at the hospital.
I wrote that down. Yeah, the use of the word, was interesting.
So she would have seen refugees. She worked at a hospital, I believe. So she draws on this a little bit in her story.
Background knowledge, sure. Yeah.
So, Sarah, how about you? Like, what stood out for you in this book?
For me, I think it was the humor. Mm. I'm not sure we've read such a humorous book since, like, Bleak House. Mm. And there was just so much funniness with Hastings' lack of introspection. Mm. And although I had to, I know you said in the last episode he was probably, like, mid-30s, but I had to think he was 22 or something based on like how he was acting and like especially being towards the ladies and his just sort of obliviousness to people's behavior and implications. To me, having Hastings kind of comedic relief and just I forget how many times I was going to try and count how many times he notes like Poirot looked sorry for him.
Or how many times he's sorry for Poirot. He's like, oh, you could tell the old man's mind was starting to fail him.
But he would ask like some dummy question and Poirot would just look at him in this sad way. I really liked the humor in this one, especially.
And Hastings is a recurring character in many of the Agatha Christie Poirot novels. I don't think he's in either of the other two we're reading this year. He's not in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. And I don't think he's in The Murder on the Orient Express.
I haven't read that one yet. I've seen the movie, but luckily I've forgotten it. So I'm likely to be surprised.
All right, I'm going to spoil that one, guys. Poirot did it. Okay, I'm sorry. I had to be that guy. I'm very sorry. We talked a little bit about Mrs. Englethorpe last episode. This is our second podcast episode on The Mysterious Ferret Styles. And one thing that I wanted to just bring to attention about how, for me, unlikable almost all of the characters were, except maybe Poirot and Hastings. When Mrs. Englethorpe is dying, and she's gasping loudly, and you can tell, like, she could barely breathe. They're trying this hallway door, and they cannot bust through this door. So there are two other doors they can try to get through. On one side of her room, she shares a door with her husband, Alfred Inglethorpe, and on the other side, she shares a door with Cynthia, who works in the dispensary at the Red Cross Hospital.
Oh, that's like an ice cream cake.
We're hearing, folks, I don't know if you can hear the
on-purpose ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck going down the street of our studio.
Summers
it's all professional here.
We paid that ice cream truck.
I was like, is somebody's phone ringing?
I thought it was my phone. I was horrified.
You have an ice cream phone.
Listeners, we're just going to pop outside for a second. We're going to get a little,
you'll never know.
Ice cream bar. Yeah.
Let it ride out.
Yeah. So there's these two other doors that people can get through. Alfred Inglethorpe's door is locked. And Mary Cavendish is found shaking Cynthia, trying to wake her. Oh, the door is bolted from the inside. And then later that's confirmed by the younger brother, Lawrence, who says, yes, the door was bolted from the inside. Folks, the door was not bolted from the inside. They're both lying to cover for themselves, because Mary Englethorpe had been wandering through Mrs. Englethorpe's room, and Lawrence thinks Cynthia committed the murder, so he's covering for her. Meanwhile, they cannot make it into this woman's room. I'm shocked that they faked this bolted lock.
Well, now Lawrence didn't know, right? When they were trying to get in, because they just assumed it was always bolted.
Right.
But Cynthia's wasn't, because Mary went out of it. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember, how did Mary get into the room? Did she have...
I think she just walked in.
Did she have the key? Yes, okay, so she got straight in, bolted the door, and then went out into Cynthia's room.
She didn't bolt it.
No, but she bolted it. She didn't bolt the door between Cynthia's room.
Right.
But she bolted the door to the hallway.
Yes.
and then went into Cynthia's room and left it unbolted.
You have like 8 people standing there looking at each other funny. How do we get into her room? Go through the door. I was shocked. I was like, oh my God, if I were... I hope to never be Emily Englethorpe with a team of 8 people who are too stupid to try a door.
Right. Well, if I'm going to play devil's advocate, it was usually bolted. But it only wasn't because Mary escaped out of it.
Right.
So it's really mostly on Mary. Who knew it was unbolted.
And she's a little culpable there.
Yeah, and I guess she thought it was beyond saving.
I'm not a big fan of Mary's.
She's an interesting cat.
So tell me why you say that. I want to hear what you think.
That she's an interesting cat?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's not very sympathetic, but she's also like... She's more interesting than a lot of the other lady characters we've read, you know? She's not totally flat or insipid or, like, doesn't fall into a fever all the time. She's, like, she's the first character who's led an interesting life and is planning on leaving her husband. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, that's really different.
Yeah.
And she's beautiful. And they're all beautiful, of course, except for poor Marion. But,
Evie?
Evie. Oh, I mean in the other book.
Oh, Marion Halcombe. Oh, in the Woman in White.
Yeah. Yeah, she's the only unlucky, unbeautiful one. You know, but she's beautiful, but they kind of refer to, like, this wildness in her.
Yeah.
Which is usually not something we've seen referred to before in any, as an attractive quality in any Mary. Of the ladies. Yeah, so Mary's like...
And with her friendship with another man, that was
interesting. Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah. I read somewhere that some of her behavior was fed because she was worried that she accidentally had poisoned Emily. So she was worried the whole time that maybe she had accidentally killed her.
Right, but while she's still... I think that's a great point, but Emily's still gasping in that room. Maybe she can be saved. Right. Nope, the door's locked, bolted, can't get in.
Yeah. Everyone's definitely extremely self-serving.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It is... It's a sad story in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, even though I said I was struck by the humor, the backdrop is really very kind of empty and sad.
Yeah.
All the wealthy people just being selfish and ratting each other out, sort of.
And then Evie comes across as the outlier, and she's as self-serving as any of them, we learn. Yeah,
she's
in
more
the final
diabolical.
Pages.
Well, and Poirot kind of called it in a way because he was asking, I'm paraphrasing again, but he was asking Hastings, like, you know, why don't you think Evie did it? And she's like, well, because she was clearly fond of her. And Poirot's like, pfft. Anyone clever enough to commit a murder is clever enough to pretend to be fond of somebody.
Yes.
And there you go. There you have it. But
And so, Jill, what's your take on Mary?
Yeah, she was mysterious. Hastings seemed to also have a crush on her.
Yes.
Right? He had a crush on all the women, sort of. I was very curious about her, and I connected her with Cynthia, with the whole, I had wondered if she had drugged, because it was so hard to wake up Cynthia. Mm-hmm. I wondered if Mary, since she'd been in there and was trying to get her up. Mm-hmm. So that occurred to me. I felt kind of smart about that part, even though the rest of the book fooled me. Yeah, she had me going. I was very curious. She had been sitting outside the window when they were having that conversation, and I didn't really know how that was affecting her. I was very curious about her.
Yeah, so she clearly knew that it wasn't an argument with Alfred. She knew it was an argument with her husband. Mm-hmm. She wasn't saying anything at any point to anyone ever. Right. Like, the whole pride, her pride in the story.
She kept a lot of secrets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything turned on pride with her, and that was, I thought, stupid. That bugged me in the last story, too. We mentioned, what's her face? In Trent's last case. The only girl. But she never talked to her millionaire husband because, or like corrected him or had it out because of her pride.
Mrs. Manderson.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. we'll call her Mrs. Manderson.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that, so you wrote a note about that too, about just this absence of communication and all of the problems that it causes.
Yeah, yeah. So it kind of, it tied into what Poirot was saying about a woman's happiness. And he knew that John being on trial for murder would bring out the best in Mary mm-hmm. as his wife. And that would overcome her pride, and then John would be reunited, and then the marriage would work out. And I was like, that's cool and stuff, and I like that romantically. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if you're not working on the pride, like, what's the very next thing that's mm-hmm. going to bother you that you're not going to talk about and become, like, a barrier to your marriage?
Right. Yeah, there was a lot left unsaid between John and Mary Cavendish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're both sort of leading these side lives. He was all out having an affair with Mrs. Yes. Rakes.
Right.
With another married lady. Yeah. I was flabbergasted. I guess I'm so old-timey.
Well, yeah, but also in the time period, so you know, I'm thinking like 1920, surely no one had an affair in 1920, which is ridiculous. I mean, totally ridiculous. But to see it right there on the page, I was blown away by that to some degree. And then Mary, it's just, that's a red herring. Like, she's not yes. really in a relationship with this guy. She is pretending to like him.
Yeah, she just kind of wants to make John jealous.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, were either of you, I was a little, like, squidged out by Hastings' fantasies about Mary and how he would go to sleep at night dreaming about yeah. her. And I thought, yeah. this is your buddy's wife.
Yeah, that was it. Was,
I don't know. Maybe I'm being old-fashioned there. I don't know.
No, I thought it was... Because he's like... It was very weird because he was very good old boys about John. Like, John. John's my buddy. John's a great chap. And he even, like, tells Mary that mm-hmm. and gets all offended on his behalf. But then... Poirot said the funniest thing. He was like, oh no, she doesn't love that doctor. She loves someone else. Mm-hmm. And Hastings is immediately like, oh, is that me?
Right, yeah.
Oh, Hastings is so funny in this book.
Oh, he's really funny in a terrible but also funny way. Mm-hmm. I don't hate him, even though he is appalling. I like him.
Yes.
That pride thing and not communicating, I wonder if that's a bit of the time frame, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the the upper class not putting their problems out to air. Mm-hmm.
To even themselves or their spouse.
Unless somebody's listening in a window.
Right.
Which they are.
Mm-hmm.
Right, mm-hmm. So rather than talk to you, I will simply go off and have an affair with Mrs. Rakes. Yes. And she says, rather than talk to you, I'll let you have this affair with Mrs. Rakes and pretend I'm having an affair with Dr. Bauerstein.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird.
Like, it's goofy. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I'm very much for, you know, whatever flaws that may be in me. Like, have it out, you know? Yeah. Get mad.
Right. Like, here it is. Let me know.
Say some words.
And so she married John basically because it was the best option she had, but mm-hmm. she wasn't in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is this a common theme in literature? Is this more bluntly stated in this book than maybe some other books? So, I mean, how did you feel about her statement about her marriage to John?
Well, it's probably pretty honest for the beginning. Clearly, she grew to care when she found out he was cheating on her. That's interesting. But I do think... that a lot of that is, again, the time period, you know, and how people handled things.
Yeah, I think it's common enough at the time, mm-hmm. and I think it's common enough today, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting when you said that.
I know more than one person who grew up in tough homes, and marriage felt like a way out of that. And I don't know that everyone is necessarily as truthful to say, I'm not in love with you, but I'm going to marry you. But I think maybe people are less truthful with themselves. And they're like, it just feels like love
okay.
because of where they're at and what they want in life. But it they're maybe playing more into self-deception mm-hmm. because it turns out to be, you know, a poor choice.
Or kowtowing to social norms or what they think mm-hmm. is expected of them. And I definitely know people that have done that in this century.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, so why can she tell... Why can she be honest in various scenes with Poirot and Hastings, but not with her own husband?
Yeah. Is she honest with Hastings and Poirot?
She says, I'm married to get out of the monotony of my life. I told him the truth. I was honest
with
him.
Well, yeah, she told him that. She told her husband that. I think she can only be a little bit unkind. Like, she can't be vulnerable. Like, she can tell him she doesn't love him. She can't tell him she does love him.
Aha.
Yeah.
And that she's hurt.
Okay.
That's more vulnerable. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the deal with Mary.
Pride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she's ready to walk out. She can tell you she's walking out, but she's still not going to tell you she loves him.
Right.
She just makes it seem like a mutual decision, and they're mm-hmm. tired of each other. And
yeah. And so we... just to stay on Hastings for a second, because I want to talk about the... end of the book and what Poirot does to reinforce a woman's happiness.
Yeah.
But because we're talking marriage, there's also a marriage proposal in the book.
Yeah, I loved it. It was stupid.
Tell us.
Well, it was another, you know, marriage of convenience. When Cynthia was concerned that now that Mrs. Inglethorpe was dead and Mary hates her and John and Mary will get the house and she's going to have to find somewhere else to live. And of course, Hastings is like, Mary hates you. What? That's crazy. Marry me.
Just threw it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Which he felt a little goofy about it himself afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Because she laughed at him.
Because
yes.
She, I know. I was like, okay, first of all, he's a complete goofball.
Yeah. What's she supposed to do, honestly?
But I was shocked she laughed at him.
I think, what other choice did she have? You have to pretend like he's joking. Or you're going to have an awkward, serious conversation. It's much easier to laugh and dismiss, pretend like you're dismissing it and leave. Again, conversational avoidance.
Right. And so then my question is, if she was in such dire straits as she says she is, why not accept Hastings?
Right. Do you think she already knew that Lawrence liked her?
Well, she liked Lawrence.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. She might have had an inkling there. She's a working lady. She might have been fine on her own.
I mean, how unappealing is Hastings that when she has no better shot at the present, she says no in 1920?
Right? Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that scene was super interesting. The proposal comes seemingly out of nowhere because his brain is this whole weird fantasy thing where he starts unraveling these ideas rapidly, and he's like, well, she's actually much nicer than Mary's ever been to me, and she's and so he starts building this immediate, like, instant case for Cynthia out of nothing, and then it all comes crashing down when she laughs and walks away. I don't know, it's a weird scene. And then at the end, we learn John Cavendish has been on trial and he's suspected for the murder and, you know, he might be proven guilty. But Poirot knew he wasn't guilty. And he still allows this whole case to proceed. Like, what's going on there? That threw me.
The woman's happiness part?
Yes.
Yeah. She's trying to unlock her love for John.
Wow. And so you let a man go on trial for his life.
It's like facetious because Poirot knew he won't go to jail. He won't get executed.
He's so confident.
He knows he can save him. And he's used this whole time period, it seemed like, for Hastings' like dummy behavior to completely put the real murderer at their ease.
Mm-hmm.
In the background, Hastings is just going around whispering all this nonsense to everybody about him working with Poirot and what he thinks he knows, and the doctor's been arrested. And
yeah,
I mean, he's just this funny little gossipy guy spinning around saying silly stuff to everyone.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. and really working on Poirot's behalf without realizing it.
Yes, yeah. He's the perfect companion from that perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole idea that, so Poirot is so deep into the psychology of people, he can tell that by allowing John Cavendish to be put on trial, Mary is going to double down and stand by her man, and the two of them are going to come through this stronger than they've ever been before. And I come away super impressed with his ability to understand her psychology, or the psychology of woman, a woman's happiness, but also sort of like amazed by it, that he would go through all of that. It seems like part of it is the Sherlock Holmes thing we saw earlier, where it's just, I like the fun drama and the sort of, you know, crazy spinning about and the wondering what's happening and the red herrings and the, you know, turning left, turning right, and then it ends up being this other thing altogether.
Well, how could he have gotten John Cavendish to not go on trial? That's escaping me at the moment. Because didn't he have to kind of still find some clues to get Evie and Alfred? He was looking for stuff all the way up, and then there was this stuff about the letter that got stuffed in a vase or something, and he couldn't find it, and Hastings, like, put him on the right track, and then he found it, and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was some loose ends, I think.
Yeah, I'm not particularly sure how he could have got Cavendish off before he went to trial.
Maybe he just needed more time.
He could have said, like, don't do it, I know he's innocent. And his reputation could have helped him, but it seemed almost to me like a necessary distraction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When he gathers everybody in the room and, you know, at Stiles Court, and then goes through all the pieces of the puzzle, that becomes a thing that is going to be repeated many, many, many times. So that idea that there's this limited cast of characters, just these people in or associated with the house, and then at the end you bring them all back together in the room and you start one by one, and as you're talking through what happened, it looks like you're about to say this person did it or that person did it, and then of course at the end it ends up being this wholly unexpected person.
Good. The person I already got off from doing it did it.
Exactly. The person we thought it was at the beginning turns out to be the person who did it.
Yeah, that was surprising. Mm-hmm. The most obvious person did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely was like, okay, well, I guess it's not that guy. It's got to be somebody else.
So clever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's several other scenes that I think are really interesting. Like when Hastings falls asleep at this tree.
Oh, yeah. And he wakes up and hears their fight.
Mm-hmm. And it brought me back to every uncomfortable fight I've ever witnessed.
Oh, where I'm tell like, me.
Well, you know, just, I mean, it's either in your house you're witnessing a fight, or you're out somewhere else, or you're at someone else's house, and they either know you're there, and, I mean, that's how much they don't care. They're like, right. I have stuff on my chest, and I'm going to share it right now. I don't care who's around. Or you're within earshot, like Mary is when her husband's fighting with Emily Inglethorpe, or like Hastings is when he's hearing Mary and John fighting, and you're in this position of like hearing this entire angry story. I don't know. It's the most uncomfortable thing I think in the world. It's like, oh, I'm going to disappear now into a, you know, hole in the ground, or make myself, as I've discussed in a previous podcast, when I was a child, I could make myself invisible. And I always wish I retained that ability as an adult. Because there are times where you're like, oh my gosh, I do not want to be here right now in this space listening to... You can't unhear what you're hearing.
Right.
You know, it's like it's removing this veil of privacy between two people, and you just don't want to be privy to it.
I would say I don't want them to know I'm privy to it. I don't mind hearing it myself.
That's honest.
I don't mind hearing a fight, but I don't want them to feel uncomfortable knowing I've heard it, mm-hmm. you know?
And if they didn't know you were there. Right. I mean, it does baffle me when people really let loose in front of...
Yeah.
But you get to know them a little differently.
And you also get to know something about their relationship that So, you know, I've talked with both of you, you know, recently, and with a bunch of people actually, about how it's hard to know what's happening inside anybody else's four walls. Mm-hmm. So, like, you think this family or this couple or what, you think they're doing great, and then you find out otherwise. And you thought you had a pretty good handle on it because you're a family member or you're a very close friend. And it's just really hard to know what is going on. Mm-hmm. So when someone has the public fight, like John and Mary, oh, it's clear what's, you know, like, it's like, I was actually more comfortable not having, I didn't need all of this information, right. You know, it's too much.
I suppose the people that do it in front of people knowingly, then yeah. Maybe they're more secure in their relationship because they don't care if you know. I don't know.
Yeah, I do know some people who are comfortable sort of arguing with their significant other in front of people.
Like a serious argument?
Like not a joking one, but not like screaming at the top of their lungs, but uncomfortable enough that you're listening to it and thinking like, I should not be here. Do they remember I'm here? I'm right here.
I don't know if that sort of person thinks that everyone else agrees with what they're saying. Like, oh yeah, everyone thinks this person's being a dummy right now and I'm just going to say it. Or they think their significant other is comfortable with that. Because usually there's an aggressor and an aggressee. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily, I don't know.
Probably not a whole lot of premeditation going on
there. That's what I was thinking. It's just like something, there's a trigger pulled and suddenly you're like, oh,
it's gonna happen.
Know, yeah, it's you're not. There's nothing to rein you in. You're just like, bam! I'm gonna have this conversation right now. I don't care who's around, and I'm like, I care who's around. Yeah, hi. I'm tiptoeing the other direction, and yeah, I get very uncomfortable when I'm around other people who are fighting.
That's interesting.
I do too. I think that's normal.
Yeah.
Not enjoy that.
Well, you know. Sarah's sitting here going, oh no, I'm fine with it.
Just so long as they don't know that I'm uncomfortable with them observing me listening. But if I was just listening to a recording of it, I wouldn't care.
Okay, gotcha. That's a little different.
I still would. I anger and anger directed toward other people, I get so uncomfortable with it. Just like,
do you have arguments yourself?
Of course.
You have anger and you direct anger
at times, yeah.
Or do you have like really, really calm arguments?
Mostly calm, but not all calm. No, I have anger and express anger, and some of it's rational and some of it's not. It's not common for me. It's more common for me to address something in a calm way with somebody. I also, for the most part, try not to let things spiral so far out of control that the trigger is basically a tap on my shoulder and I just like, I'm exploding,
right.
Which is not uncommon with people, right? Like, mm-hmm. They've said so little about what's irking them that it gets to this place that you do almost nothing and they explode.
Mm-hmm.
I'm for the most part not wired that way. And there are some things in my life that I've been part of, witnessed, or, you know, in conversations I've had where I've been very mad. But that's not my norm.
Which is good. Good for you.
I don't know.
Good for you and those you are angry at.
So Sarah, different for you?
I would say it's been a lot of work for me to rein in anger. I've never been one to like publicly fight. I feel like that's very bad form all the time. But I can feel like very intense levels of anger, and it's been a practice over the last, I don't know how old I am, like 25 years to get a little bit better at having less emotional conversations about things I am dissatisfied with. So, but you know, your partner kind of has to join with you there. If you have a partner that's like, I also want to do this versus I'm going to stab you and make you mad. And
yeah,
there's a balance there. Yeah. Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. I was telling Jill, I think our neighbors, it's a revolving door of neighbors. It's constantly different people renting next door. And the common characteristic that they all have is that they're fighters.
Oh, really?
It's always a couple, and they are always at each other audibly in the, you know, if it's the summer, the windows are open. If it's the winter, for some reason, they're outside. Like, and yes, a good chunk of yesterday that they were screaming at each other. I know way more about these two strangers who I'm sure will move out in the next 3 months as that happens in that house. I know way more about them than I should know. And I don't want to know all of this about them. I just stop. Like, stop. Go back in your house.
Right. Close the windows. We didn't have an argument.
Yeah. It's the winter.
Inside. God, go inside. Yeah. I don't know. I've always been uncomfortable witnessing anybody else's anger.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just, there's some sort of pain body in me or something associated with.
Well, I think that's normal. It's very awkward. Even though, like you just said, we don't know everything about everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, as I get older.
I do know everything about them. Yeah,
because they're broadcasting it. Mm-hmm. It's the show that, your entertainment for the evening.
Yeah, but we don't know everything. Yeah.
You know, right? Yeah. I mean, benefit of the doubt, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to Hastings for a minute here because I love one of these questions that we haven't really addressed about him.
Yeah.
And that's the Poe's narrator versus Watson versus Hastings, mm-hmm. and maybe any of the other narrators mm-hmm. that we've run into. Mm-hmm. Who was Lady Molly's narrator again?
It was her secretary, who also had a name that started with M. Mary.
Mary, yes.
Mary.
Yeah, another Mary.
Yeah.
So you, as what way are they variations on a theme, and what way do they differ? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts there?
So Poe's narrator, Murders in the Rue Morgue and the Purloined Letter, is unnamed, and he's, in my mind, quite arrogant for no legitimate reason, simply by association. Dupin is really smart. I'm associated with Dupin, therefore I am very smart. And Hastings has a lot of that as well, but the humor and just sort of the way in which the reader can see how silly Hastings can be, whereas there was nothing silly about Poe's narrator.
Yeah.
As a person I'd want to talk to and hang out with, that would be Watson or Mary. Watson, I think, is just pretty level-headed, really smart. He can't see everything Sherlock Holmes sees, but I felt very Watson-like. My body of knowledge or understanding of whatever was happening always seemed no further than where Watson was. I never landed where Sherlock Holmes landed. And Mary in Lady Molly of Scotland Yard is also, like Watson, really just level-headed, savvy, can jump in and play a role, can help out with the case, doesn't really know as much as Lady Molly, but like the best helpmate possible. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, well, they're all sidekicks. And they all have, you know, they all sort of present a screen, mm-hmm. you know, that we're seeing the geniuses through. Mm-hmm. And we can't quite penetrate mm-hmm. into what the genius is thinking because the screen can't quite penetrate. Yeah,
it's definitely similar to the reader and like I said in the last episode, kind of the opposite of the crime solver, mm-hmm. whoever that might be. Yeah, at least Hastings is. He's a lot less intellectual.
Yeah, I feel like I can't get a good feel of Hastings. Like, would I have Hastings to a dinner party? I have no idea because I'm seeing Hastings through Hastings' eyes.
Yeah.
And right. I only every once in a while through something that he records Hercule Poirot saying, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, you're being stupid. So,
and the reactions of the other characters right. towards him are similar. To
right.
That. Do we get to know him better in the other books?
Well, we see, yes. Eventually, I believe he gets married.
Oh.
So, you know, we see various, you know, evolutions, revolutions and evolutions of Hastings. He always comes across to me as sort of thinking perhaps a little more highly of his shrewdness and his ability to discern what's going on than the reality. But he's also narrating, so he's in charge of the story. He's, as Sarah would say, such a ding-dong. He includes these details in his own narration. If I were him, I would have edited some of this
stuff. I still don't think he knows that he was looking like the fool there.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just recording the facts.
I think he'd be great at a dinner party. He's social. People like him. He comes into the Cavendish family and, you know, stays with them, I guess, days or weeks or
something. He was going to stay like his whole convalescence or something.
Right. And he fits in immediately. Oh, it's tea time. Oh, it's the cocktail hour. He's great. So I think he'd be wonderful at a party. I don't think he and I would be, you know, best buds or anything.
Maybe.
No, he'd be your, he could be your best bud. I'm going to take Poirot. Probably be my...
Yeah. I mean, Poirot's great. But does Poirot have a best bud? I don't know.
It's Hastings.
So.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Think of him? Yeah.
Well, I love what he said here about Hastings. And I kind of agree. And I think Poirot is also being a little bit serious. Mm-hmm. So at the end of chapter 13, when Hastings gets offended, everything comes out and he realizes Poirot left him out of the loop. And Poirot says, "I did not deceive you, mon ami. At most, I permitted you to deceive yourself. You see, my friend, you have a nature so honest and a countenance so transparent that to conceal your feelings is impossible." And Hastings is even offended at that, being seen as transparent. And Poirot says, "My friend, I implore you, do not enrage yourself. It is but the extremely beautiful nature that you have," which made me pause. And I know a few people like that. And I do. Sometimes you're like, what? And then other times I'm like, but that is such a beautiful nature. And thank you for thinking so many nice thoughts about me.
So Hastings is almost like a spurned girlfriend half the time. Oops. It's like, he gets upset at Poirot, and so he's like, "Well, I'm not even going to go visit him. Right. I'm not even going to go see what's going on." You know, so he's like waiting for Poirot to show up and apologize or something like that. It just really felt at times a little childish, but also charming.
Yeah, it is a lovely thing when you meet someone that is almost innocent and transparent. Mm-hmm. And they're very nice. They like he liked everybody. Hastings liked everybody.
Yeah.
Except maybe Alfred. Yeah. But even when he thought they were potentially murderers, he was rooting for them, which was appalling, but that is his nature.
Yeah.
He's really the only one that was doing that.
Yeah.
Everybody else was kind of...
They're all unlikable and kind of mean to each other and suspecting everyone else, and he's just out there liking people.
Trying
to marry people.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, overall a good guy, I think, and I think Poirot recognizes that, and they're going to make a good pairing in a lot of these Agatha Christie stories. So we've covered a lot about the mysterious affair at Styles, which the three of us loved. But I want to hear, before we wrap up here, from Jill a little bit about your writing, your art. Tell us what you're up to.
Okay. Well, I'm working on finishing a memoir that's based in my association with place and places I love and care about, some that are gone now. And then I do write for publications around Colorado on various subjects. And my art has turned very abstract and colorful after I had broke my leg back in November and was laid up for a while. And I always enjoyed doing art, but I needed kind of a less intense. It's very joyful to do abstract art for me. I don't know if that is for everybody, but I've greatly enjoyed doing that. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, and so at Graffiti Rainbow. Is that correct?
The the art, yeah, and yeah. It's spelled kind of funny. It's more like a graph, graffiti, G-R-A-P-H-I-T-T-I. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I was thinking there. I was trying to be different.
I'm going to make this really hard to broadcast really hard on for a anybody podcast. To find me. I'm going to spell it for you.
And then, yeah, some of my writing is on letters from Miss Jill on Instagram also.
Yeah. So it's an advice column you do in Denver.
The parent, yeah, that's actually a column in the Denver North Star mm-hmm. newspaper, and that's loosely advice. Mm-hmm. I just kind of ponder and put out ideas. I usually always point out a researcher or a book.
Yeah.
Or an event that inspired me. The last one I wrote was about the show Family Affair. Do you remember that show? That I'm aging myself.
I don't remember.
It was a late 60s show.
Okay.
About Brian Keith was in it, and he's so handsome. And I never thought of him that way when I was a kid, but he's a very handsome man, well-off man in New York who's single, who ends up adopting his brother's children, and he ends up being a great parent. Okay. So I use him as kind of a single dad, you know, single dads can do it too, you know.
Nice.
So
okay.
That's the next column.
Now I want to see this.
And I'm going to Google Family Affair. It sounds familiar, but I'm like, I don't know if I have. Buffy I've seen a lot of old shows.
Yeah. That was something I ended up watching when I couldn't do anything else after my surgeries.
And oh, awesome. So then you can still find it.
Yeah, then I started going, hey, this is actually a pretty good show.
Yeah, and a good sort of touchstone or something for the ideas you're sharing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good examples in it of good parenting, I thought.
And so The Mysterious Affair at Stiles is also on BritBox, Amazon Prime, and most of the David Suchet plays Poirot. Most of those are like an hour, you know, 45 minutes, an hour long. This one's a 2-hour movie that they made of neat. This
That's
book.
Cool. Yeah. I'm watching it.
And it's good. And then once you watch that one, I mean, if they have the free week or month, or I don't know what they do for BritBox, but highly recommend do that and just binge as much Agatha Christie as you can.
But not the ones that we're going to read before you read them.
But not. And what are those, Sarah? Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got The Murder of Roger Ackroyd coming up, which blew my mind the first time I read it. I was like, what? And then Murder on the Orient Express will be later in the year.
Yeah, we already spoiled that one. That was Poirot, did it.
Are you kidding me?
Stop saying that.
I have to read it now.
So are you going to read more Agatha Christie, Jill?
For sure. Yeah, I'm hooked.
I thought that's why I got this book and I was like, a twofer. I'm probably going to want to read more. Yeah. So I'll just get this two in one.
Curtain but. May be the last Poirot.
I'm thinking that it is. I think this was set up to be the first and the last this volume.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I want to jump to the last one.
No, I think.
But there's only like 900 Agatha Christie books, isn't there?
Well, no. I don't remember the number. You would think I would because I read it at the beginning of this episode.
I swear I read. Okay, yeah, you like 200 something?
No, more
than that.
Fewer. I don't, 200 total. I don't know.
Did you? Because I don't think it was in there.
I feel like it was, but I lost that sheet entirely.
It
so
flew off.
It's.
Oh, here it is.
There's a massive stack of papers around us, people. You have no idea.
Like papers.
Yes. Yeah, so what does it say? Near the end.
Well, Poirot has been in 33 novels, but it doesn't have a total for Agatha Christie.
Okay.
It just says Poirot totals.
If I had to guess, I'd say she's done 80.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, this has been fun, Jill. Thank you so much for being our guest.
It's been delightful.
Very fun.
Yay.
Got me to try Agatha Christie.
And everyone should try Agatha Christie. It's awesome.
Absolutely. All right. Until next time, stay mysterious.